From the Next Big Idea Club, I'm Rufus Griscom, and this is Book Bites. 5 key insights from Ozan Vural's Think Like a Rocket Scientist, simple strategies you can use to make giant leaps in work and life. Our very own Dan Pink says this book will make your thinking bigger, better, and bolder. Here's the author.
Hello, members of the Next Big Idea Club. I'm Ozan Vural. I worked on the operations team for the 2003 Mars Exploration Rovers project. I later pivoted to become a law professor and author to inspire others to level up here on Earth. My new book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist, is a culmination of that lifelong journey. Here's the basic idea from the book. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to think like one. I'm going to share with you 5 key insights from the book. The first insight is about the importance of reframing problems to generate better answers. The year was 1999. I had just started working on the operations team for what would later become the Mars Exploration Rovers mission. At the time, our mission was to send a single rover to Mars in 2003. In 1999, as we were busy designing our own rover, another lander called the Mars Polar Lander crashed on the Martian surface. Now, this wasn't our baby, but the Polar Lander was using the same landing mechanism that we were planning to use. Our mission got put on hold, understandably, since our landing mechanism had just failed spectacularly. We were scrambling to figure out a way to fix the landing mechanism and come up with a new way of landing on Mars. I remember distinctly when my boss, the leader of the mission, walked into my office and said, "I just got off the phone with the administrator of NASA, and he asked, can we send 2 of these rovers instead of 1? It was such a simple question, but one that none of us had thought of asking before. The NASA administrator reframed the problem. The problem wasn't just the landing system. Because even if we fix the landing system, sending a delicate robot to Mars is really risky. Any number of random things could break our spacecraft while traveling nearly 40 million miles through outer space and landing on a Martian surface littered with scary-looking rocks while getting whipped around by strong winds. Instead of putting all our eggs in one spacecraft's basket and crossing our fingers that nothing bad happens along the way, we decided to send 2 rovers instead of 1. Even if one failed, the other might make it. What's more, with economies of scale, the cost of the second rover would be pennies on the dollar. The rovers were named Spirit and Opportunity. We had built them to last for 90 days. Spirit lasted for 6 years until it got stuck on soft soil, but Opportunity kept roving the red planet until 2018, over 14 years into its 90-day expected lifetime. This story illustrates the difference between strategy and tactics. Although the terms are often used interchangeably, they refer to different things. A strategy is a plan for achieving an objective. Tactics, in contrast, are the actions you undertake to implement the strategy. To find the strategy, ask yourself, what problem is this tactic here to solve? Once you move from the what to the why, once you frame the problem broadly in terms of what you're trying to accomplish, instead of your favorite solution, you'll discover other possibilities lurking in plain sight. So to go back to our Mars rover, if you frame the problem more broadly as the risk involved in landing on Mars, not just as a defective landing mechanism, sending 2 rovers instead of 1 decreases risk and increases reward. Breakthroughs, contrary to popular wisdom, don't begin with a smart answer. They often begin with a smart question. The second insight from the book that I wanted to share with you is about first principles thinking. Now, sticker shock isn't in the vocabulary of most Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, but that's what Elon Musk experienced as he shopped for rockets to send a spacecraft to Mars. He looked to buy rockets on both the American and the Russian markets, but the rockets were way too expensive, even for his budget. He was about to give up until he realized his approach was deeply flawed. Returning home from his last shopping spree in Russia empty-handed, he had an epiphany. And he arrived at this epiphany using a principle from physics called first principles thinking. First principles requires you to hack through existing assumptions as if you're hacking through a jungle until you're left with the fundamental components. Everything else is negotiable. Instead of letting your original vision or the visions of others shape the path forward, you abandon all allegiances to them. When you apply first principles thinking, you switch from being a cover band that plays someone else's songs to an artist that does the painstaking work of creating something new. In trying to buy rockets that other people had built, Elon Musk realized that he was playing the role of a cover band. And for him, using first principles meant starting with the laws of physics and asking himself, what's actually required to launch a rocket? He stripped a rocket down to its smallest subcomponents, its fundamental raw materials. And it turned out that if you buy those raw materials on the market and build the rockets from scratch, it was around 2% of the typical price of a rocket, which is a crazy ratio. So Musk decided to construct his next generation rockets from scratch. If you walk through the halls of SpaceX's factories, you'll find people doing everything from welding titanium to building in-flight computers. First principles thinking prompted SpaceX to question another deeply held assumption in rocket science. For decades, most rockets that launched spacecraft into outer space couldn't be reused. They would plunge into the ocean or burn up in the atmosphere after carrying their cargo to orbit, requiring an entirely new rocket to be built. Now imagine for a moment doing the same thing with commercial flights and torching an airplane at the end of each flight. That's basically what we did for rockets. The cost of a modern rocket is about the same as a Boeing 737, but flying on a 737 is far less expensive because jets, unlike rockets, are flown over and over again. SpaceX and Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' space company, changed that. Since then, both companies have refurbished and reused numerous recovered rocket stages, sending them back out to space like certified pre-owned cars. So that story illustrates the importance of questioning assumptions and applying first principles thinking. Your assumptions are your windows on the world, said Alan Alda. Scrub them off every once in a while, or the light won't come in. But ask yourself, what do you assume you're supposed to do simply because it's been done before, or simply because others around you are doing it? Can you question that assumption and replace it with something better? In the book, I reveal additional tactics you can use to question assumptions and apply first principles thinking in your life. That brings me to the third insight. Success is the wolf in sheep's clothing. When we succeed, we assume that everything went according to plan. When we're too busy lighting cigars, we fail to recognize that we succeeded despite making a mistake or despite taking a serious risk. We ignore the warning signs, the near misses, and the necessity for change. This is why the Challenger and the Columbia space shuttles exploded. In both cases, NASA got complacent with its own success. The Challenger exploded because of a flaw in what are known as the O-rings. These rings are like rubber bands that seal the joints of the solid rocket boosters that launch the shuttle and prevent hot gases from escaping. The problem with the O-rings wasn't new. NASA had been flying its shuttles with damaged O-rings for several years before Challenger. As one flight after another was completed successfully despite dangerous levels of damage to the O-rings, NASA began to develop institutional tunnel vision. The anomaly eventually became the norm. 17 years after the Challenger disaster, it happened again. In February 2003, the space shuttle Columbia blew up, tragically killing all seven astronauts on board. This time around, the culprit was a large piece of foam that separated from the shuttle and damaged the insulation responsible for protecting the shuttle from the heat of re-entry. The foam debris had struck and damaged the shuttle in the past numerous times. But these launches were all characterized as successes because the damage from the foam didn't compromise mission safety. As a result, foam shedding, as it was internally called at NASA, became an acceptable way of doing business, despite the serious risks it presented. Between the Challenger and Columbia, the technical flaw was different, but the underlying cultural flaw was the same. NASA didn't just have an O-ring problem. It also had a complacency and conformity problem. For NASA, a long string of successes created complacency with the status quo. Success boosted egos. success put blinders on the most capable engineers and managers working at NASA. But just because you're in a hot streak doesn't mean you'll beat the house. It can be harder for us to survive our own success than to survive our failure. The moment we think we've made it is the moment we stop learning and growing. When we're in the lead, we assume we know the answers, so we don't listen. When we think we're destined for greatness, we start blaming others if things don't go as planned. We launch space shuttle missions even with glaring problems with the spacecraft. So the next time you're tempted to start popping champagne corks following a victory, stop and pause for a moment. Ask yourself, what went wrong with this success? What role did luck, opportunity, and privilege play? And what can I learn from it? If you don't ask these questions, luck will eventually run its course, and the near misses will catch up to you. The fourth insight from the book is do not fail fast. The fail fast, fail often, fail forward mantra is all the rage these days in Silicon Valley. Failure is viewed as a secret handshake shared by the insiders. Countless business books instruct entrepreneurs to celebrate failure. There are now conferences like FailCon dedicated to celebrating failure. Silicon Valley companies hold funerals for failed startups, complete with bagpipes, DJ spinning records, and alcohol flowing freely. I don't buy it. I don't buy it for two reasons. First, when we celebrate something, we don't learn from it. And second, regardless of what Silicon Valley tells you, failure sucks. Whoever says they celebrate failure and they don't mind failing is lying to you. I've failed more times than I care to remember in my life, and every time it stung. Because there's a value judgment attached to failure. Failure is bad and success is good. But this aversion to failure can be paralyzing. Behind every canvas unpainted, every goal unattempted, every business unlaunched, and every book unwritten is the looming fear of failure. So it can be just as dangerous to celebrate failure as it is to demonize it. Rocket scientists apply a more balanced approach to failure. They don't celebrate it, but they also don't let it get in their way. They know that failure can be the best teacher if you know how to approach it properly. They also know that all breakthroughs are evolutionary, not revolutionary. If you're trying to achieve something transformative, you're not going to succeed on the first try. Einstein's first several proofs for E equals mc² failed. SpaceX's first three launches were spectacular failures. The British inventor James Dyson spent 15 years creating over 5,000 versions of his bagless vacuum that failed before he made one that worked. We have an obsession with grand openings, but the opening doesn't have to be grand as long as the finale is. And the best way to make the finale grand is to learn from your failures and get better with each iteration. In the end, our goal shouldn't be to fail fast. It should be to learn fast. The fifth insight from the book is the power of flip-flopping. And the example here is from the Mars Climate Orbiter, which was launched in 1999. The orbiter was designed to be the first spacecraft to study another planet's weather from its orbit. But sadly, the orbiter burned up in the Martian atmosphere after entering Mars at an altitude of 57 kilometers, which is far below the intended altitude of 150 kilometers. What happened to the orbiter takes me back to my high school physics class. Our teacher would give us 0 points for an exam answer that lacked units of measurement. She had no mercy. Even if the response was correct, we'd fail if we wrote down 150 as opposed to 150 meters. I had a laissez-faire approach to units of measurement and didn't get why they were such a big deal until I learned more about why the Mars Climate Orbiter was destroyed. It turned out that Lockheed Martin, which built the orbiter, was using the English inch-pound system, but JPL, which navigated the orbiter, was using the metric system. When Lockheed programmed a piece of trajectory software, JPL engineers assumed, incorrectly it turned out, that the numbers were in newtons, which is the metric unit of force. All relevant measurements were all off by more than a factor of four. JPL and Lockheed Martin were speaking different languages, and neither team was aware of the problem because both groups forgot to include units of measurement. In other words, these rocket scientists would have all failed my high school physics class. During the cruise to Mars, the data show that the spacecraft's altitude would be lower than expected when it entered Martian orbit. Still, the navigators assumed the error was with the navigation software, not with the spacecraft's trajectory. There was a gap, which went undetected, between the story the data told and the story the rocket scientists told themselves. It goes to show, even rocket scientists can have a hard time thinking like a rocket scientist. Progress, whether in science or in life, occurs only through generating negative outcomes, by trying to rebut rather than confirm our beliefs. So switch your default from proving yourself right to proving yourself wrong. When your focus shifts to proving yourself wrong, you'll seek different inputs, you'll resist deeply entrenched biases, and you'll open yourself up to competing facts and arguments. The point of proving yourself wrong isn't to feel good. The point is to make sure your spacecraft doesn't crash, your business doesn't fall apart, or your health doesn't break down. Our goal should be to find what's right, not to be right. In addition to these five insights, the book shares numerous other insights with the readers. I'll just give you a few examples here. You'll learn the biggest mistake businesses make in generating ideas, why subtracting rather than adding is the key to originality, and what George Costanza and rocket scientists have in common, and what you can learn from both in starting your next project. And I'll close things off by sharing two book recommendations with you. And I picked books that you may not have heard of. So these were not written by any of the curators of the Next Big Idea Club, and they were not featured in previous selections. One is nonfiction, the other is fiction. The first is called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress by Christopher Ryan. Ryan's argument is simple and meticulously constructed with supporting evidence. There is a serious mismatch between our genetic makeup and the modern conditions of Western civilization. We're apes dressed in suits, eating a diet, and living a lifestyle wildly out of touch with how our bodies and minds were constructed. The second is a fiction book with quantum physics. It's called Dark Matter by Blake Crouch. Crouch manages to weave quantum mechanics into a mind-bending story that kept me reaching for the book every time I had a few minutes to spare. If you like sci-fi or gripping thrillers, or if you simply want to get your mind blown, do yourself a favor and pick up a copy. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, there it is. The key insights from Ozan Varal's dazzling debut. Go to rocketsciencebook.com to learn about the special bonuses you will receive when you pre-order Think Like a Rocket Scientist.